So the emergence of Sharia courts in rebel-held Syrian territories has attracted some media attention. The Jabhat al-Nusra's supposed links to al-Qaeda and their public display of support for Ayman al-Zawahiri, which could be interpreted as a bay'ah or an oath of allegiance, is clearly a concern in Washington and London. And they, Washington and London, don't want to end up supporting the establishment of Sharia law in Syria. Since the Free Syrian Army is made up in large part of Ikhwani sympathisers, the post-Assad Syrian state, if we can imagine it, is likely to be decidedly heavier on Islamic rhetoric, and the legal system will surely come under pressure to become more intimately linked with the Sharia. The root of concern, I think, over the establishment of the Sharia amongst the Western policy circles and the call for its implementation amongst the rebel forces, both reveal a certain mythology about the nature of Sharia law. Namely, that there is this thing called Sharia law, which is a particular legal regime can be measured against to be assessed whether it is more or less in conformity with the Sharia. My argument here will be not only that this is merely what Wittgenstein might call a beetle in a box. In Philosophical Investigations, Wittgenstein introduces the famous and memorable analogy of the beetle in the box. Suppose everyone has a box that only they can see into. No one can see into anyone else's box. Each describes what he or she sees in the box as a beetle. I know what my beetle looks like, you know what your beetle looks like. Wittgenstein points out that in this situation, while we all talk about beetles, there might be different things in everyone's boxes. There might be nothing at all. The thing in the box could be changing all the time. Whatever it is, he maintains, whatever it is, the beetle, it cannot have any part in the language game. This, I would argue, is how Sharia law operates in the discourses both of the rebels and of Western commentators. Those of us trained in the study of classical Muslim jurisprudence get very annoyed with the way the word Sharia is used by journalists, politicians, fellow academics, even some leaders within the Muslim community. For the majority of thinkers in the classical period, the Sharia was, for a large part, unknowable. It referred to the rule of God, the divine law. Anyone who claimed to know what the Sharia was, for most classical Muslim jurists, was raising himself to the position of God, and therefore almost committing a sin, or the crime, if you like, of shirk or association. There were a few classical jurists who claimed to know what the Sharia is, or be able to know the Sharia if they applied it themselves, in both the Sunni and the Shi'i legal traditions. But such thinkers were marginalized by the mainstream in the tradition. Most scholars prefer to talk of their opinion as to what the law of God might be. Even when a jurist talked about an overwhelming opinion, ghalbat adhan, as they call it, they recognized that this was, ultimately, their own personal opinion. Hence, it is not surprising that the reference to Sharia law says this, or Sharia law demands that, worries scholars of classical Muslim legal thought, and to an extent that includes myself, and to an extent Muslim scholars who have been trained in the classical curriculum also. The term Sharia law was once an expensive commodity, and now it is sold at a cheap price, with everyone claiming to know what it means and how it should or should not be applied. Now, in the UK, there is a heated debate, as we all know, about whether or not the Sharia is to be given any formal official status in the legal system of England and Wales, and in separate arguments in Scotland and Northern Ireland. And whilst there are many commentators who have expressed the view for or against such proposals up to now, there has been little debate about what Sharia law is. Two examples will be enough. Anjum Chowdhury has spoken of the flag of the Sharia flying over Downing Street by the year 2020, since he claims by that date Britain will have become an Islamic country as a result of at least 500 converts a day. Alternatively, in November 2008, the production To Be Straight With You opened in London and examined the religious roots of homophobia. At one point, the main character stated that more than 80 countries still criminalise same-sex relationships, and under Sharia law, the death penalty is invoked in 7 of them. In November 2009, there was a large demonstration in London named One Law for All, No Sharia, of which this is the website, and one of the organisers said, "Whilst other faiths are also often oppressive, Sharia law is especially oppressive." Now, both examples are likely to frustrate the scholar of classical Muslim jurisprudence because both view Sharia as a largely unproblematic body of legal norms which pre-exist any attempt to implement them. The debate is still in its early stages. However, the participants are not yet able to distinguish between at least three things. This is my view. First of all, different customs of social organisation and individual behaviour within the different Muslim communities, both of the UK and the Muslim world more generally. These originate in the country of origin of the community, but have undoubtedly been changed and morphed following immigration. The debates around so-called honour killings and arranged forced marriages are examples of this lack of clarity. That is, whether they are part of the Sharia or not. Secondly, there are different regulations propounded by Muslim scholars who claim to be rational in the sense of textually derived, but are in fact religious norms created within the methodology of classical discipline of fiqh, that is, Islamic jurisprudence. This is not surprising, since the scholars concerned have often been trained within this tradition. So, the hijab-niqab debate, that is, the amount of covering that is appropriate for a woman, is an example of this. It's also a debate about the amount of covering which is appropriate for a man, but this gets very little media attention about the hijab debate. This category conflates at least two things which many reform-minded Muslims wish to separate. On the one hand, what the sources say, the Quran especially, but Hadith also for some. And two, what the fiqh says, what works of fiqh say the Quran and Hadith say, which is a different thing, perhaps, from what the Quran and Hadith say. So, the third thing which it conflates, I think, is the laws of the country of origin of the immigrant populations under which individual members may be married or under which there may be some financial arrangements made. For example, a polygamous marriage contracted in Tunisia is not recognized in English law, but a polygamous marriage contracted in Saudi Arabia is. This seems like a contradiction. It should also be noted that a lack of clarity over... So what is the Sharia here is my question, I suppose. It should also be noted that a lack of clarity over the legality of an act in the country of origin will also result in a lack of clarity in an English court. So the imprecise wordings of Somalian inheritance statutes has resulted in various cases involving inheritance between Somali British citizens. Now, each one of these three instances of confusion are norm-producing mechanisms, and some of those norms look like law in the sense that it is often understood in the Western legal academic tradition. Of course, the three mechanisms interact in ways that are well known to those of us that study the history of law in Muslim societies. Sometimes these three will produce a very similar norm. Usually, they will differ within and between themselves. Now, we all know that the breakdown of collective religious reasoning in Europe through the Reformation process resulted in a personal and private notion of religious truth emerging from a healthy disrespect for both tradition and the state. In the light of these developments, the most convincing candidate for the location of the Sharia is the second of the above three norm-producing mechanisms. Norms justified through reference to the sources are always going to be more convincing than those touched by Reformation ideals, whether they are religiously Muslim or are Western commentators and academics. Those justified by custom or by the state do not appear as the true Sharia for most commentators. If I take an example, and I have a handout here. If I take an example, I've got enough. Maybe you'll have to share. Of a recent publication in the American Journal of Comparative Law. By John Jupp, which is a really quite interesting article on how in the Afghan interim criminal law of 2004, interim criminal procedure code of 2004, many parts of the code in Afghanistan have been transplanted, many parts of this code implemented in Afghanistan have been transplanted into the Afghan context. And in the course of that article, Jupp examines whether this criminal code, which is taken from external sources and transplanted into the Afghan context, whether it works, whether it achieves its objectives. And one of the problems with it, from his perspective, is that it contradicts the Sharia. So on the text there, I have his commentary, if you like, on the his assessment of whether this code of law, this code of criminal law, which was transplanted into Afghanistan after the fall of the Taliban, it works or not in relation to the Sharia. So he says the ICPC, that's the Interim Criminal Procedure Code, also fails to contain any provisions which specifically draw on procedural rules from either of Afghanistan's customary or Islamic legal traditions. Some of its provisions are nevertheless consistent with the Sharia. The principle of presumption of innocence provided in Article 4 of the ICPC is confirmed in the Quran. Note his appeal to the Quran as an evidence that this is in conformance with the Sharia, which state, and it's not, this actually isn't a verse from the Quran, it's a hadith, but never mind. He got his reference wrong there. It's confirmed in the Quran, which states, remove punishment as often as you can and set the accused free if he has a chance, because it is better for the judge to be wrong in acquittal than to be wrong in punishment. There are no principles in Islamic law contradicting the ICPC's provision in Article 52 for the public conduct of a trial. And the juryless trial system prescribed by the code is consistent with the Islamic legal system as well. Furthermore, the right of the suspect and of the accused individual to remain silent under Article 5 of the ICPC is consistent with Islamic law, which affords the accused a right to refuse questioning and remain silent during the investigation of hudud crimes. In addition, there is no prohibition in the Sharia. He really is able to pronounce about the content of the Sharia here. In addition, there is no prohibition in the Sharia of the right to legal representation, which is guaranteed under Articles 5, 18, 19, 38, and 41 of the ICPC. Islamic law also acknowledges a right to a fair trial without undue delay, and while this is not explicitly provided for in either the ICPC or the Constitution, the ICPC specifies detention periods for compliance by the police and prosecutors in Article 36, 164. It is also subject to the repugnancy principle in Article 3 of the Constitution, which affirms that no law can be contrary to the beliefs and provisions of Islamic religion. As Sharia is constitutionally confirmed as the basis of all law, essentially the ICPC cannot contravene it. As a result, the ICPC is not completely insulated against the influences of Islamic law. Still, the procedures prescribed by the code are at odds with the Islamic model of criminal justice in many respects. The code provides processes for obtaining evidence borrowed from Italy, which are distinct from the Islamic rules of evidence, traditionally based on oral testimony and confessions. More generally, the westernized procedural system encapsulated in the ICPC that favors objective judicial analysis of legislative rules contrasts with the Islamic model of criminal justice, jurisprudence, which centers on the endeavor of judges to reach decisions based upon their subjective interpretation of the religious sources. Now, it's not a particularly contentious or position to hold at the face of it. But, of course, the problematic element for me here is that the constant reference to the content of the Sharia and the principles of Islamic law seem to me to arrogate the commentator to the position of being able to judge the compatibility of this criminal code with this thing which he calls the Sharia, as if there is a pre-existent thing called the Sharia which we all have access to and which we can easily compare this criminal code to. This is not an isolated example. It is an example taken by me simply going onto the search mechanism and putting in Sharia law in all the law articles which have been published recently, and this was the first one that popped up. Okay, it is a repeated heuristic technique, if you like, of people working within the field to argue as if Sharia law was unified, undisputed, and completely available. And that is one of the things which I wish to question. And Jupp is particularly beholden to this paradigm in terms of his analysis. So, if I move on to looking perhaps at what some of the constitutions of some Muslim countries have done in terms of incorporating the Sharia, supposedly, into their legal practice. And here I'll move away from my text and look a little bit more discursively at the Iraqi constitution, which I have the Arabic here on the page, and which the English translation is there for those of you that read Arabic. So the constitution of Iraq, of the Republic of Iraq, mainly in the commentaries, you will read the fact that stated boldly that the Sharia is incorporated into the constitution of Iraq. In the post-Saddam constitution of Iraq. Article 2, first part, Islam is the official religion of the state and is a basic source of legislation. So this is al-Islam dina dawla wa rasmi wa huwa master assas al-Sharia, li-tashri' rather. Now, for Islam to be a basic source of legislation is not necessarily the same as for the laws of Iraq to be commanded to be in conformance with the Sharia. So even though the commentators regularly talk about the conformance of the promise within the Iraqi constitution to be in conformance with the Sharia, you don't find that necessarily explicated within the constitutions themselves. And followed by the first one, لَا يَجُوزُ سَنْقَنُونَ يَتَعَارَدْ مَعَ ثَوَابِتْ أَحْكَامْ الْإِسْلَامِ. No law can be passed that contradicts the undisputed rules of Islam.
Those of us that study medieval Islamic thought realize that the undisputed rules of Islam are extremely few.
There are disputes over most areas of Islam, except perhaps for some areas of theology. So, no law can be passed that is not that does not contradict the undisputed rules of Islam is not a particularly restrictive element in terms of lawmaking within the Iraqi context.
If we move on to Article 92,
the Supreme Federal Court is an independent judicial body. Financially, administratively, its work and its duties will be defined by law. The Supreme Federal Court will be made up of a number of judges and experts in al-fiqh al-islami.
Min adad min al-qudha wal-khubara fil fiqh al-islami wa fuqaha al-qanun.
Now, those of you that know Arabic, this is not, as is often glossed, a reference to the conformity of the legal system within Iraq with the Sharia, but instead with the need for experts in fiqh, that is, Islamic jurisprudence, to be contributory members of the judiciary. It is not necessarily identical with the Sharia. What's interesting here is the reluctance, I think, of the Iraqi constitutional framers to use the word Sharia at any point in describing their legal system. That's the simple point I want to make. Move on to the constitution of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan, in which we have a Dari and a Pashto text there, for those of you that read those, and English text on the handout here. So the sacred religion of Islam is the religion of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Followers of other faiths shall be free within the bounds of the law in the exercise and performance of their religious rituals. So I've just done the first point here, which says, هیچ قانون نمیتواند مخالف معتقدات و احکام دین مقدس اسلام باشد. Notice no reference once again to the word Sharia. Similarly, the care with which the framers have put Article 35, to attain moral and material goals, the citizens of Afghanistan shall have the right to form association in accordance with the provisions of the law. The people of Afghanistan shall have the right, in accordance with provisions of the law, to form political parties, provided that Their manifesto and charter shall not contravene the holy religion of Islam and principles and values enshrined in this constitution. So once again, we have... this is the bit where it's talking about the manifesto and charter. So, Muram Name, Ba'asas Name, His, Munnaqize, Ahkam, Din, Muqaddes, Islam, Ba'nusus, Ba'azeshhaye, Mondareje, In Kanun, Asasi, Naboshad. So the people are allowed to form association as long as they do not contravene the holy religion of Islam. Once again, a reluctance, I feel, to use the word Sharia as a defining element of a foundational legal document. It is perhaps in the Egyptian constitution that we find the most explicit, if you like, reference to the word Sharia in the recent constitutional movement. So here we have al-Islam din wa ad-dawla wa lughata al-arabiyya lughataha ar-rasmiyya wa mabada' al-sharia al-islamiyya al-masdar ar-ra'isi li-tashri. So on the handout there, Islam is the religion of the state. Arabic is its official language, and the principles of the Islamic Sharia are the main sources of legislation. Once again, though, be aware, it's not saying that the Islamic Sharia is the main source of legislation. It is saying that the principles of the Islamic Sharia are the main sources of legislation. And that's not insignificant, considering that Article 219 defines what these mabada al-Islam, mabada al-Sharia al-Islamiyya are. Mabada al-Sharia al-Islamiyya tashtamal adillataha al-kulliyya wa qawaiduha al-usuliyya wal-fiqhiyya wa masadiraha al-mu'tabira fi madhahib ahla sunnah wal-jama'ah. The translation on your handout, 219. The principles of the Islamic Sharia include its general indicators, its usuli and fiqhi maxims, I'll come back to that in a second, and its authoritative sources according to the schools of the Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah. So, what does this mean? It means that what the Constitution means by the principles of the Sharia is the tools used by a jurist in deriving the law from the sources. It doesn't mean the Sharia. It means the tools used by a jurist, such as the adilla, the sources, al-adilla al-kulliya, normally meaning Quran, Sunnah, and Ijma'ah. These are the general sources. This is not Sharia, but the sources from which, by the qawa'iduha al-usuliyya wal-fiqhiyya, the jurist, the principles, the theoretical and practical legal principles, maxims, which the individual jurist can derive the law from the general indicators, and its authoritative sources, وَمَسَادِرَهَا الْمُعْتَبَرَ. Change the translation if you like. I'm using the official one, which they put on the website. According to the schools of the Sunnis, and a significant element of Egyptian national unity is the need to emphasize its... That when they talk about the principles of the Sharia, they're talking about the Sunni principles of the Sharia. Let's just make this clear, okay? Now, even in the Egyptian context, where there is the most explicit reference to the Sharia, even here it is a qualified reference. It is not that this constitution sets up the situation whereby all law must be in conformity with something that is called the Sharia. Rather, that this sets up the situation where, theoretically, all law should be in conformance with the principles of the Sharia, which is a slightly different thing. And I don't think they make these constitutions by accident. I think they're careful about the words they choose. So my point is this, that whilst Western commentators are quite often keen to posit the notion of the Sharia, and indeed, some participants within the intra-Muslim debates and the debates between Muslims and external commentators might posit the notion of a Sharia, the actual constitutions of the countries of the Muslim world, and I've just picked out three at random, are reluctant to use the word Sharia as a foundational element of their legal status in the form of constitutions. So this is what I want to emphasize. So the Western discussions of Sharia have taken the rhetoric of rebel groups, or indeed of activists such as Anjem Chowdhury, and assumed that we know what we're talking about, rather like the beetle in the box of Wittgenstein. And the constitutions have been made more careful in cases than Western commentators. And this is due in part, I think, to the recognition of the essential unknowability of the Sharia within the Islamic theological model and as well in the pre-modern classical tradition generally. And I think that the pre-modern classical tradition can enable us to locate the problematic elements in the current employment of the term Sharia, both within Muslim discourse and outside of it. And I think here, everyone here will know that within the classical tradition, the means whereby a legal rule might be known was, of course, the process known as ijtihad, an individual jurist's effort or attempt to reach a conclusion about a legal norm. The formulation of the definitions of ijtihad reinforce the point which I would like to make. There is a clumsy definition of ijtihad in probably the earliest work of Usul al-Fiqh, that is, Islamic legal theory, hopefully it's there, by Ahmed ibn Ali al-Jassas, who died in 980, who says that ijtihad is to expend great... It's clumsy, not just in the Arabic, but also probably in my translation as well, for which I apologise. Ijtihad is to expend great effort to acquire what the mujtahid aims for. This is the mujtahid is the person qualified to exercise ijtihad, this effort which you do in order to discover a legal rule by examining the sources. Ijtihad is to expend great effort to acquire what the mujtahid aims for and what he pursues, though it has come to mean, in common parlance, anything which is not clearly indicated by God in such a way that we have knowledge of the desired thing. Now here the phrase is of great, expend great effort, is badal al-majhud in Arabic. An alternative formulation can be seen in the Zahiri thinker of Ali ibn Hazm, who died in 1064, who writes, ijtihad is to expend effort, istifraq al-wus, in the search for a ruling. Ibn Hazm is, of course, highly critical of the way in which the fuqaha employ ijtihad. He is a person who is famed for his criticism of ijtihad, but his definition of the term is not overtly affected by this stance. So the two formulations of badal al-majhud and istifraq al-wus are brought together in Abu Ishaq al-Shirazi's text. Ijtihad is to expend great effort. This is my failure to be able to distinguish between the two terms in Arabic, in the search for a legal ruling, which in Arabic is istifraq al-wus wa badal al-majhud fi talab al-hukm al-shar'i. Al-Ghazali, sorry about these definitions, but it proves more. Al-Ghazali prefers to combine the two phrases, and ijtihad is the expending by the mujtahid of effort in the search for knowledge of the rulings of the Sharia, ahkam al-Sharia. Both solutions, that of Al-Ghazali and Shirazi, are compromises, combining the previous phrases together, and they do this differently. Shirazi by saying that it is both istifraq al-wus and badal al-majhud, and Ghazali saying it is badal of the mujtahid's wus, for those of you that know Arabic. The phrasing is a useful indicator of a settled intellectual tradition in terms of ijtihad that now has a standard definition and a place within a theoretical science of legal theory. So something changes, though, with Fakhruddin al-Razi. Fakhruddin al-Razi, who died in 1209, develops the already commonplace notion that the rules of the law are divided into two. There are legal matters which one should not extend effort in finding the legal ruling for, because the texts are clear and unproblematic. These are ahkam al-Sharia. There are, however, legal matters where this is not the case, and in these matters, ijtihad becomes necessary, and no blame is attached to the scholar who, in these matters, fails to find the ahkam sharia. Hence, he defines ijtihad in the rather complex phrasing, Ijtihad is the expending of effort, istifraq al-wus, in the consideration of things attached to which there is no blame for the expending of effort in them.
Al-Amidi
says that ijtihad is the expending of effort in the search of an opinion of something from the Ahkam Sharia. So here the transition is complete. For the early theorists, those of you that haven't managed to follow the definitions of ijtihad, this is what I'm trying to say. For the early theorists, Jassas, Ibn Hazm, ijtihad was the search for the ruling of the Sharia on this or that issue. For Ghazali, it was the search for the knowledge of the legal ruling. And one can see a creeping subjectivism coming in here. Not the seeking of the ruling, but seeking the knowledge of the ruling. Ahmadi achieves the full transition to subjectivity in the knowledge of the Sharia. Ijtihad is expending effort not to find a legal ruling or to find knowledge of a legal ruling, but to find an opinion of something from the Ahkam Sharia. That is, gradually, the epistemological line has been moved backwards, away from the object, such that the actual Sharia is no longer an object of inquiry. This change in definition is not simply a matter of inserting words into the definition. From Ahmadi onwards, most definitions of ijtihad focused on the process as being a means whereby an individual scholar, by looking at the sources, can discover his own opinion of what the ruling within the Sharia might be. In the classical framework, his was an opinion, a than. Other scholars could have different opinions, and hence we all have different opinions. And hence there is lots of different opinions, and we have what they call ikhtilaf. Since most legal questions were, in fact, masail ijtihadiyya, that is, questions which are subject to ijtihad, the end result is that, theoretically speaking, very little can be known of the Sharia. The contrast with contemporary expressions of certainty concerning the Sharia's content, either from within the Muslim tradition or outside of it within the academic commentary and the media, is striking. So moving on to my conclusions. I'm not saying anything particularly radically new for those of you who have worked and looked at the Islamic legal tradition. For example, Norman Calder, in an article in 2001, text E on the handout. What, in an Islamic context, could be the referent of Islamic law, he asks. The problem is that law is radically ambiguous in an Islamic context, since it might refer to literature or to practice. The connotations of the phrase Islamic law are now, in part, a product of Western perception and have been introduced now into Muslim societies through linguistic calques such as the Arabic Al-Qanun al-Islami. His point here being that we use the term Islamic law or Sharia as if it's an easy thing to locate within Muslim discourse. In fact, it's an extremely difficult thing to locate within Muslim discourse, apart from as a theological notion of which there is no precise content. And now I'd follow that up with saying that you can also see this in the work of Baudouin Dupré, who in this a very interesting article discusses the claims that you often find within the legal literature, of which I mentioned at the beginning is a classic example, in which you compare two laws and say one is in conformance with the Sharia and one is not. Or you compare two judgments of a judge and say one is in conformance with the Sharia or not. One finds this regularly repeated throughout the Sharia. Dupré says this, and I can't express it better than him. My contention is that these claims are sociologically irrelevant, for they eschew the praxeological dimension of adjudication. Instead of assuming that there exists something called an Islamic personal status law, to which judges necessarily conform, it would be better to examine and describe judges' actual daily activities and practices through which they manifest their legal knowledge, their formal and practical legal training, and the routinized nature of their activity in the field of personal status law. Thus, scholars should not presume the Islamic nature of rulings on the basis of their genealogical connection with the provisions of an earlier legal system, either fiqh or the practice of Islamic law in previous centuries. For this would be to adopt an ironic position by which the scholars tell the judges what is Islamic and what is not in their daily judicial practice activities. That is, by positing the notion that we know what the Sharia is, we then judge judges as to whether they are being Islamic or not, which Duplay says is just a fallacy, really, in terms of a procedurally false assumption on which to base your academic examination. Instead, any ascription of an Islamic dimension and authority to rulings should proceed from the judge's personal characterizations and orientations, to which only a close scrutiny of actual interactions and utterances bear witness. In other words, there is no valid preconceived model to the yardstick of which one can evaluate actual judicial practices. The Islamic nature of rulings is something that is instantiated and realized by the actual written and oral performances of the judges, not by conformity to some external, pre-known, pre-existent code. So, because the operators and agents we are examining, and which we'll go on to look at tomorrow, talk about the Sharia, and commentators sometimes consider this a known entity, and then make it a category of analysis, I think this is the problematic element, that the notion of conformity with the Sharia becomes a category of analysis amongst Western commentators, as well as people within contemporary discourse within the Muslim community and outside of it. This, I would argue, is a misunderstanding of how Muslims use the term Sharia in everyday discourse. It is not a known thing, but as a totemic term for and how it is conceived within even the most rudimentary of Islamic legal theologies. I've noticed that academics and commentators no longer talk about the Arab Spring. Instead, they're referring to the so-called Arab Spring. Rather like spring itself this year, it's been a little disappointing. There's been little blossom and few flowers following the uprisings in North Africa and the Middle East. Ancien regime structures have proven more durable than initially thought, and 2 years on, the overthrow of Mubarak looks like a decapitation rather than a revolution. The military retains much power, and the president regularly ignores the popular will. The real revolution, though, may well have been mental, not physical. Real substantive ideological debate has replaced the monotony of past official deliberations. So in this new context, the traction gained by Islamist appeal to Sharia law has startled some commentators. But this should not really be surprising. If opposition figures were to cease referring to the Sharia, now that would be strange indeed. Understanding the persistence of the appeal of Sharia law, one must first recognize how Sharia is hardwired into Muslim thinking about justice and equity. The Arab uprisings have been fueled not by an upsurge in supposed democratic instinct, but rather an anger at injustice and corruption. The Sharia represents the alternative, the administration of moral and pious society operating in accordance with core Muslim values. Such an ideal inevitably and naturally dominates any call for political change in the Muslim world. This religious law forms an essential component of any wannabe politician's platform. Sharia values, in popular rhetoric, will always trump democratic ones, and in the popular ethical imagination. So theologically, the Sharia is the law given by God to his world as a guide for creation. To act in accordance with the Sharia is to follow the rules set down by God. And there is no aspect of human life which is not covered by it. And the rules have not always been the same. At different points, God revealed new laws for humanity to follow at different points in history. This we all know from basic standard accounts of the development of Islamic legal thought. But at the death of the Prophet, the Sharia is supposedly the last of the laws. Permitted things are permitted until the day of resurrection, and forbidden things likewise, as numerous law books say. But the Sharia's permanence does not convert, I would say, into continuous access. Whilst it exists forever, it is only fully available with an infallible prophet, now gone. Discovering the Sharia's rules has been recognized as problematic by jurists for much of Muslim history. And God did not reveal a law book or a written constitution in which rules were laid out for easy reference. Instead, for Muslims, he revealed texts, the Quran. He inspired actions, particularly those of his perfectly obedient servant, the Prophet Muhammad. These form the sources of the Sharia and as such need interpretation. And the result, of course, with the interpretation is variation in rules. The Sharia, God's law, is always one, but human attempts to understand it are multiple and individual. The law promulgated by humans is not the Sharia, but fallible human understanding, the fiqh of the Sharia. Muslim jurists from the medieval period to the present have recognized and incorporated this variation both in rules and in practice into their jurisprudence. So different judges have ruled according to different law schools, with different rules of evidence applying in different courts. It's one of the great achievements in many ways of Muslim history that such a potentially chaotic system actually functioned as a means of distributing justice. It was not perfectly efficient, but then what system is? And the results may not always have been to a modern ethical taste. But the legal experience of the Muslim world is evidence that legal pluralism need not lead to anarchy. So the centrality of the Sharia as a theological ideal and as an inspiration to proper ethical and civil behavior explains why it is such an emblematic value for Muslim political movements, both in power and in opposition. Effective government depends on legitimacy, and legitimacy ultimately comes from the conformity, or at least perceived conformity, to an accepted system of values. In the Muslim context, this value system is the Sharia, and the totemic Sharia punishments, lashes for drinking alcohol, stoning for adultery, amputation for theft, are almost always the first to be proclaimed by a movement claimed to be Islamic. This is why the Syrian rebel forces almost unanimously will proclaim that the restoration of the Sharia is their political objective. The Sharia commands the good and prohibits the evil, and this may or may not entail democratic rights depending on the movement's interpretation. But the call to the Sharia will invariably form the core of any effective political program in the Muslim world. Thank you for your attention.